Welcome to Reinventing You. I'm your host, Danielle Silverman. I believe that in today's world of ever-constant evolution, the only career change that matters is when what you do matches who you are and what you believe. This show is where you'll learn how embracing change and reinventing yourself will help you navigate any disruptions and lead a life of happiness and fulfillment, especially in this ever-changing world. Your purpose and your meaning will drive your personal transformation. As I like to say, it's your vision, your life. Be passionate about it. Reinventing You starts now. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Reinventing You. My name is Danielle Silverman. Reinventing You is a show about everything career related. And reinventing your career is the central theme here. But it would be impossible to talk about reinvention without talking about change. And yet, change is a dirty word for so many people. So today, I thought I'd dispel any fears you have about change and talk about courage. Courage in a way that will help you hopefully embrace change and even make it your friend. I know that sounds like a tall order, but we'll see. First off, I'd like to make it clear that there really is not much difference between being fearful and being courageous. The only difference is that the fearful person listens to her fears and follows them. But the courageous person goes into the unknown in spite of all the fears. In fact, courage does not mean fearlessness. The courageous person knows the fears. The fears are there. They're ever present. But she chooses to set them aside. So how do we break this down? Well, I'm going to take you on a little bit of a journey today in ways that are a little bit different than what you're used to. Because it turns out that everything we know about change, we learned in the first 2 months of life. When we think about change, it often brings up strong emotions. So really, the best thing is to talk about these emotions, to find out where they come from. Think about what's the biggest thing that holds you back when speaking about change, about personal reinvention, about your career reinvention, about changing jobs, about looking for a job. You might be asking yourself, okay, which path do I choose? Or maybe you're so overwhelmed that you're sitting in inertia, not doing anything. Or maybe there are too many shiny objects out there and you don't know which one to choose. You choose all of them in serial order. Or maybe you're suffering from imposter syndrome. So many people I talk to say the same thing. I have imposter syndrome. I'm afraid I won't be good enough for this job, or I won't be able to do that. We don't change because we're afraid. But it's not intellectual. No amount of technology or of business knowledge is going to solve the problem of fear, because that's an emotion. It's the psychological, emotional aspect that has to be addressed first, because it's not a matter of will. It's not a matter of just soldiering through or being strong. It is fundamentally a question of biology. So we need to understand that biology. We need to respect that biology if we're going to be successful. You know, whether we're talking about the way we eat and sleep and exercise, or about the way a company brings products to market, everything we do brings with it some form of change, and that change brings fear. So as I said earlier, everything we learned about change, we learned in the first 2 months of our life. Because that's when patterns started to emerge in our brain, in the brain stem, the very back of the brain. So it is biology, it's neurology. And what happened is that these neurons, these memories, these things that happened in the first 2 months of our life got rooted in the brainstem. And that part of the brain doesn't know any sense of time. It's not conscious of any sense of time. So whenever you're triggered by something, anything that may have happened, that pain that got stored in that part of the brain in very, very early childhood is happening over and over and over again. So let me explain. If we look at a newborn infant, and let's say this is a healthy environment, right? Something that happens many, many times during the day. I'm going to show you a picture. Hopefully you'll be able to see it. And if you cannot, well, I will explain it. So here, make sure I'm in front of the camera. So what happens, this is a normal experience, a healthy experience. A child of about up to 2 months, sometimes 3 months, but usually within the first 2 months of life. And this is an experience that happens, let's say it is an experience that happens 80% of the time. Okay. These blue squiggly lines that you see here, this is discomfort. So let's say that my diaper is dirty and it needs to be changed, or I'm hungry, or I'm cold, or I don't know, I have a pain somewhere. Well, I'm going to cry, and I'm going to fidget, and I'm going to feel that discomfort until the moment somebody comes and gives me some comfort, which is this little green box here. Okay. And as soon as I get fed or as soon as my diaper gets changed, I calm down. And then what happens after that? Most people say, oh, then the baby falls asleep. Well, that happens afterwards, actually, because what happens after the baby receives that comfort is that, I don't know if you can see this here, is that the baby then relaxes and processes what's going on. And that final stage is an extremely important stage because we need that time, that relaxation and the processing to understand what's going on around us. Now, obviously, in an infant that age, it's not happening at a conscious level, but it is happening. It's what scientists call rest and digest. I called it here relax and process. Rest and digest. So there's a period of discomfort followed by someone comforting the child, either by changing the diaper, giving it food, holding it. And then the comfort is followed by a period of relaxation and processing, where you're digesting not only the food, but you're digesting emotionally, you're digesting as an adult, you're digesting intellectually, and so on and so forth. So this is the healthy stage, right? A period of disruption, followed by comfort, and then followed by a period of rest and processing. Now, when you're in this, when you're going through this normal cycle, you learn in those first two months of life that being in discomfort is not a bad thing. Because you know that that discomfort will end. You know that that discomfort will be followed by a period of comfort and a period when you can rest and relax and digest what's gone on. So this healthy cycle of discomfort, comfort, and rest and digest, if infants get it in 80% of the time during their infancy, they will be very comfortable with change because they're used to the fact that disruption will be followed by a period of calm, by some sort of satisfaction that will happen. But that's not the case for many, many people. Think of a newborn who is born with some health issues, or born prematurely, or the mother is sick and the child has to be taken away for some reason immediately after birth. So this child might not have felt its mother's touch for quite some time, or it didn't have the luxury of having someone take care of it on time. Or, you know, it might have been fed, yes, had diapers changed, yes, but on the doctor's schedule or on the nurse's schedule. I remember there was a time, I don't know which decade it was, but and it might be dating me, but there was a time, there was a theory that children had to be fed at a specific time, you know, not when the child cried, but only on a schedule. And that probably is something that disrupted many, 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 many kids, because they weren't taken care of immediately. So imagine, this is what the scenario would look like. So the period of disruption here, the period of discomfort, is going to last a very, 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 very long time before anybody comes to comfort the child. So the child could be crying, it could have a wet diaper, it could be uncomfortable, it doesn't matter what the issue is. The child is uncomfortable for a very, 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 very long time. And when the comfort comes, it's such a surprise that the child goes, oh, okay. And it doesn't really have time to rest and digest, because it's wondering, okay, well, I don't know when the next one is coming. It could be in 2 hours, it could be in 4 hours, it could be in half an hour, I don't know. So I'm constantly fidgeting because I don't know when I'm going to get that relief. This is a situation that is called learned helplessness. And it's not pleasant at all. And actually, you grow up totally fearing change. The second example I want to show you of a situation that is not like the first one I showed you is when a child who has experienced this in the first 2 months of life grows up. She's a mother now, and or a father. And as a consequence of having experienced this, she wants to compensate. And this, believe it or not, is equally, if not more, dangerous. Because what happens is, all you need is for the child to be only slightly uncomfortable, and the mother comes in and compensates greatly. And there's too much comfort too soon. So the child doesn't have enough time to learn to develop a normal tolerance for uncertainty, for discomfort. And when that discomfort is truncated, you can't really feel the joy of comfort. So your ability to experience that comfort, that love, that joy, that this is directly proportional to the level of uncertainty that you can tolerate. So as an adult, very often, this leads to addiction, because you're constantly looking for that high. Constantly looking, right? The third thing that could happen, a different kind of process, is now you're an adult again, and you're going through a normal period of uncertainty. And as you're going through the normal period of uncertainty, when it's finished, I think of you're speaking in public, okay, which could be very nerve-wracking for some people. You go through a period of discomfort, and then the speech is over, you have a period of comfort, and then you think you have a chance to relax, but then you remember, oh my goodness, I have all these emails to answer, and I forgot I have to do this, and I forgot I have to do that, and I have to call so-and-so back, and then instead of relaxing, you're spiraling down, and you have had no time to relax, to process what has gone on before, because the learning happens in the process. So if you don't take the time to process, you can't develop a healthy relationship with change. So in all three examples, it's very difficult to establish a healthy relationship with change. You either are disrupted for too long before there's any comfort, and so you don't have a chance to understand where and when the comfort is coming, or you're getting too much too soon, and you're constantly looking for, you're not used to get to what the uncertainty does. And so you always want to be on a level playing field. And the third thing that can happen is that you don't take the time. As an adult, you don't take the time to relax at the end of something very stressful. So you're not able to process what comes. And everything you've done before doesn't count for anything because you didn't take the time to digest. You didn't take the time to digest physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. And if you don't take a time of relaxation afterwards, you cannot develop a healthy relationship with change. And this is scientific research to back this up. The interesting thing is also that the earlier you experience this trauma, the more predictive it is to your lifetime success. So if you experience trauma a little bit later in life, say at the age of 3 or 5 or 10, whatever it is, then you're better off than if you experience the trauma within the first 2 or 3 months of your life. Now, it doesn't mean we're all doomed. It does take work. The interesting thing is that the brain is flexible, so we can reprogram it. The brain is flexible, malleable, adaptive. We can grow new tissue and new connections. But I think the thing to remember here, and my point in showing you all of this, is it's not your fault. It's very hard to know what happened to you in the first 2 months of life. But I don't know anybody who doesn't carry some sort of trauma from childhood. And it doesn't mean you have to have been sexually abused or psychologically abused or hit or, yelled at. It could mean being ignored. It could mean having been abandoned through no particular cause. Think of all the refugees that have come as a result of war, who've lost their parents at a very young age, possibly. Trauma is there everywhere, and it is there in varying degrees. But we can learn to work through it. And I will be telling you, I will be showing you some ways that we can turn things around. So you may not remember what happened to you in the first 2 months of your life. I know I don't. No one ever around me has ever given me any account of what might have happened. The important thing is to understand that whatever trauma there was, be it as a newborn or later on in childhood, the fear of change became instilled in you at a very young age. So let's look at these three scenarios that I gave you in reverse. And let me tell you about some of the things that you can do if it ever happens to you. So number three was you didn't take the time to rest or digest. So this is an easy one, right? After you've had a period of disruption and it's ended and so now you can be comfortable, well, guess what? Take the time to rest, relax, process, just breathe. Give everybody around you the time to have a healthy pattern as well. How much time are you giving yourself after a big project has ended, or you've done something really that takes effort, that really takes up a lot of energy? How much time do you give yourself to rest? That's the one thing you can do here, and it's probably the easiest. For the second scenario that I showed you, the one where the child gets immediate comfort, too much too soon, okay, there isn't enough disruption in their life. So ask yourself, how can I add disruption to my life? I know that sounds crazy, okay? But try it as an experiment. I know people think, oh my goodness, I can't bring more chaos into my life. Well, if you think about it in terms of careers, you will most likely go through somewhere between 5 to 8 careers in your lifetime. And I don't mean jobs, I mean careers. I mean change completely from one doing one thing to doing another thing. That's an average. So don't worry about the choice you make. You can start getting creative about the level of uncertainty that you can give yourself. Try something. If it doesn't work, you'll try something else. Think about an example when you were in that sort of state of uncertainty. But remember that your ability to tolerate risk and to experience love and joy is directly proportional to the amount of uncertainty, to the amount of disruption that you feel. So if you want to increase the level of love, the level of joy, you need to also increase the level of uncertainty to a certain degree. The next one was the first one I showed you, which was what I called learned helplessness. Let me just get the image up again. This is the image where there was so much discomfort that lasted so long that in the period immediately after having received the comfort, the child just didn't know when the next comfort would come, if it was in discomfort, right? Learned helplessness. This is perhaps the hardest thing to deal with. And really, the only thing we can do here is to be that caregiver to yourself right now by creating more care, starting with physical care. You experience a moment of uncertainty, of disruption, give yourself the care you need. Figure out what support system you need. Be that parent to yourself. Put in place some very basic needs. Are you sleeping enough? Are you eating the right foods? And of course, there are other forms of care. I mean, you could do meditation, yoga, therapy, whatever it is. You can do it for yourself. And it's also always better to do it with a support system. I learned, it's actually a very difficult lesson to learn. I have to be honest with you. It's hard to be that caregiver to yourself. It's hard to say to yourself, I'm going to go to sleep on a regular schedule, or I'm going to sleep, I don't know, set my alarm 10 minutes earlier today or 10 minutes later today. I'm going to stop eating that bag of chips every day. It's hard. Because when you're doing it, it's actually bringing more of that stress. It's more of the disruption. So we're adding to the disruption and we don't know when it's going to stop. As I said, meditation, yoga, therapy help a lot. So, regardless of which situation you identify with, if you do identify with any of them, there's still no question that the majority of people learn to fear change. And that change we can overcome. When we come back, I'll tell you more about what we can do to dispel those fears.
Have you lost sight of who you truly are? Thought leader Linda Lamp is here to help. She illuminates the divine within and walks you through the walls of illusion that hide the truth about your true nature. With her help, you can realize your true self, become a force for good, and create heaven on earth. The Internal Divinity Show, uplifting and illuminating the divine in your life. Second Tuesday of every month at 4 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Tune in to Maximum Resilience with me, Kelly Bazzani, your ally for addiction, the first Monday of each month at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join us and engage in this epic journey of how to own your power and change your perception of addiction while we revolutionize the approach that ensures mental health as we address a worldwide epidemic. Take the steps that lead you towards an incredible life of maximum resilience. We do recover. Visit MyResilienceCoach.com.
You've been listening, but are you watching? Tune in to your favorite shows on the Transformation Talk Radio Facebook page. We stream live video podcasts every day, and we love to hear from you. Leave comments and questions for the host to address live, on the air, and get to know the faces behind the voices you love. Just go to Facebook and search for Transformation Talk Radio.
Yeah, yippee-skippy to that, baby.
Are you living life in full expression? Join me, Beth Wolf, on Life in Full Expression each Monday at noon Pacific time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To learn how to explore, elevate, expand, and live your best life, discover the seven dimensions of life blueprint of expression. Get ready to fully express, develop your limitless capacity, and experience amazement to become an igniter and inspire. Visit BethWolf.com to discover the dynamic coaching of life in full expression.
Welcome back to Reinventing You. Today we're talking about the fear of change, what it means, how it happens, and what we can do to overcome it. I saw a quote recently from Stephen Pressfield, who's an author. He said, most of us have two lives, the life we live and the unlived life within us. Between the two stands resistance. I love this quote. I love it for two reasons. The first is that acknowledging that we have an unlived life within us, yes, I do, and understanding that between the two, there is resistance. So the life is unlived because I have fear. I'm afraid of changing. I'm afraid of disruption. I'm afraid of conflict. I'm just afraid. It's just plain fear. And in fact, there really are only two emotions in love. Two emotions in life. I gave away the tagline. The two emotions are fear and, you guessed it, love. Every other emotion is a subset of one or the other. So what are some of the, we'll get to love. We'll get to love soon. But what are some of the other ways one can deal with fears? So one other way is an exercise we call fear to action. So as I stated earlier many times, the issue with change is that we've grown to fear it. And we fear it because we believe we're moving towards something that's unknown or so unfamiliar that we won't be able to cope with it. Our adult brains are designed to find peace in knowing. And when we don't know what will happen, we tend to make up scenarios in our head. We tell ourselves stories and we imagine all the frightful things that go wrong. So we create worry, we create anxiety, depression, fatigue, stress, and yeah, even sometimes pain. There are many different life experiences that we would rather not change, even when making the change is a better decision. Some people stay in a job that makes them miserable because they're afraid of not being able to find another one that is as secure, or maybe they're afraid that they're too old to be hired. Some people don't want to leave a relationship because they fear the alternative of being single or having to go out on dates to find a new partner. It can be stressful. And sometimes we turn to rational solutions, or we hide behind numbing practices, mind-numbing practices. I'm trying to put the two words together, mind-numbing practices, rather than look at the emotions that come up. That's when we turn to food, alcohol, drugs, television. All of these can be addictive. And more often than not, we prefer to do nothing at all rather than face our emotions. When we're stuck in a situation like this, we often can't see clearly. So rather than trying to analyze the origin of these fears, which is what you do in psychotherapy, what we can do instead is look at how we can positively overcome our fears. So imagine walking through the forest and you come upon a bear. What do you do? Well, you're afraid, of course, right? But then what would you do? Well, our caveman ancestors would fight this fear in either of two ways, and we've inherited this. They would fight it or they would run away. What's known as the fight or flight response, the stress mechanism. It's our survival mechanism. It is a physiological response that our body has to stress, any stress that we come upon, whether it's real or perceived. And when the threat or perceived threat appears, our brain sends a signal to our adrenal glands, which are little organs that sit on top of our kidneys. And those adrenal glands then secrete hormones, which are then circulated in the bloodstream, and they allow us to deal with the threat successfully. This is what happens in the body when those hormones are released. So our heart rate, our blood pressure, and our breathing speed up. Our muscles become tense. We're getting ready to run or to fight. Then there's fat and sugar that are released into our bloodstream to provide the energy, to our muscles. Our pupils dilate so that there's more light that can enter and we can see the threat more clearly. All of these physical reactions prepare us to either fight or to run away. And once the danger has passed, our nervous system restores the body to a sense of calm. So while the first reaction to our stressor is immediate, it can sometimes take a while for our body to return to a normal state. And there's a neuroanatomist, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, who describes what she calls the 90-second rule as the ability we have to regulate this neurobiological process. And she says, when a person has a reaction to something in their environment, there's a 90-second chemical process that happens. And any emotional response is just the person, any emotional response after these 90 seconds is just the person choosing to stay in that emotional loop. So one way you can react is to just wait 90 seconds before doing anything else. And then once those 90 seconds have passed, well, maybe you can look at your fears in a more objective way. But there is one exercise that I like above all else, and that is to honor your fears. What do I mean by that? That I mean becoming aware of any emotions and honoring them. Writing down all of your fears on one big list. This will allow you to become aware of what you're feeling. So if you're unable to fully vocalize the nature of your fear, think about the potential impact or the risk that you're afraid of and write that down as well. I'm afraid of quitting my job because I won't be able I won't be able to have enough money to feed my family. The important thing is to try not to judge your fears. Most people who come to me say, it's the money issue. I can't quit my job. I can't leave the security of this job. I'll never make enough money. And I need to be able to make that much money. Take that out of the equation. Don't judge your fears. Just write them down. And if the word fear doesn't resonate with you, try calling it a risk or a challenge or a threat. You might notice that you have very few fears, but that you call them different names, which creates the illusion that there are more things to be afraid of. The next step is to work with those fears, with working with the emotions. So if you've written down all of your fears, I would recommend numbering them. You know, create a table. This is my fear, right? And this is what would happen if my fear gets realized. Number the fear, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. On another sheet of paper, friend and colleague of mine calls this a bucket list. Not, you know, what do you want to do on this earth, but the three buckets exercise. And the three buckets are, number one, what can you directly control? Number two, what can you influence or partially control? And number three, what is completely outside of your control? And then you take each one of those fears that you listed and you put them into one of those three buckets. What can I directly control? What can I influence or partially control? What is outside of my control? War is outside of my control. The pandemic is outside of my control. How I deal with it, however, is another issue. And now that you've done that, commit spending 80% of your energy to the things that you listed only in the first two columns. Because what you focus on grows. So if you focus on things that you cannot control, you will continue spinning your wheels and you will continue to stay in discomfort. And when I've done this exercise with clients, the biggest surprise for most people, and it was a surprise for me too the first time I did it, is that the majority of the fears fall into the first two buckets. There's very little that I cannot control. What we're doing now, after that, is organize these into taking some meaningful action. So it's time to use this fear in a productive way and to focus your energy on something concrete that you can directly control or influence. So the question to ask is, what concrete actions can you take that are within your control or your influence? What can you do? Who's leading the action? Is it you? Is it somebody else? Is there anyone else participating? When should it be done? How can you do it? So let me restate this particular exercise. It's called fear to action. The first thing you do is you list all of your fears, numbering them. I am afraid of this because if this happens, if this fear gets realized, this is what will happen. This is my belief. Doesn't mean it's true, but it is my belief. It's my fear. The next thing you do is take each one of the fears and put them in one of three buckets. Can I control it? Can I influence it, even if I can't control it 100%? You know, you might be in a relationship where you can do your part, but the other person has to do his or her part. So can I control it? Can I influence it or partially control it? And what is completely outside of my control. And then once you've done that, then you start putting things into some sort of meaningful action. What action can you take for the things that you listed in the first two buckets, what you can control and what you can partially control or influence? What actions, what concrete actions are within your control or your influence? What can you do? Are you leading the action? Is somebody else leading the action? Is there anyone else participating? When should you do it? How should you do it? Spend 80% of your energy and your focus only on those first two buckets, because there's really nothing you can do about the third. There's another twist on the issue of change. I'm sure many of you have heard of, if you haven't read James Clear's book, Atomic Habits. He says we often make decisions in the present based on the return that we receive. And we most often will choose a return that provides us with instant gratification as opposed to delayed gratification. For example, if I plan to lose weight, I'm thinking of the long-term benefits of the plan, but the reality is that when I'm faced with a choice, I'm hungry, or I've experienced a really difficult day or emotion, or I've just had a fight with somebody, those long-term plans fly out the window, right? They fly out the window in favor of something that's going to bring me instant pleasure instead, that bag of chips or that cookie. What is immediately rewarded is repeated. What is immediately punished is avoided. So the idea is to first take only small steps, baby steps. There's a coach of mine once called them Rice Krispie steps, even smaller than a baby step. And you know, even in job search, I interviewed a client on this podcast. He said that very wisely, he said he learned that taking small steps was the way to go. You're not going to change everything overnight. And it's okay to fall back and then come back and try again. But in order for you to be successful, the actions need to be attractive. They need to be easy. They need to be satisfying. There has to be some joy in them. And they have to be obvious. The most difficult thing is that in changing a system, that means we're changing ourselves. It means how we look at things, how we react, how we process, even how we behave. And as I said, this doesn't happen overnight, but it is possible. It's a lot. I know it's a lot to process. Small steps. I want to leave you with the opposite of fear. So I said earlier that there are only two emotions, fear and love. And so I firmly believe that another way to combat fear is to focus on its opposite, love. And you can do that by practicing something we call loving kindness. And there are many ways to do this. The one that's most talked about is loving kindness meditation. And today, loving kindness is traditionally understood to be a Buddhist concept, and it implies acting with compassion towards all sentient beings with an awareness and an appreciation of the natural world. The giving of loving kindness is an integral part of Buddhist medicine, and it has the potential to enhance modern primary health care. But it must be given with selflessness, with compassion, and with sympathetic joy. There's that word again, joy. You can find a lot of meditations on loving kindness on the internet, on YouTube, most likely a variety of apps as well. Love at its deepest and highest level means not only feelings of empathy and compassion, but also a sort of mystic feeling of oneness, a cosmic oneness. I found a passage somewhere that love is an essential element of the development of knowledge. So think about that. Learning, the gaining of knowledge, is best received through love. And love and knowledge also increase the awareness of universal responsibility. Studies have shown that loving kindness meditation can increase social connectedness as well. So during this time of pandemic, when everybody has felt, I know we're coming out of it sort of, but everybody has felt disconnected. If we had brought more loving kindness to ourselves, we might have felt more connected with other people. The Buddhists weren't the only ones to recognize loving kindness. Judaism also has a principle called Gemilot Hasidim, which is the performance of loving kindness. It's another way of saying charity, if you will. Charity in the form of monetary donation, but also by personal involvement, personal attitude and effort. I often remark to myself and to others the age-old saying, charity begins at home. Or like the mask you need to put on yourself first in the case of turbulence in an airplane. You know, they tell you in the security, in the safety instructions, if there is a change in pressure in the cabin, a mask will come down and you need to put it on yourself first. That's because if you aren't well, you can't help others. So the loving kindness, the charity, needs to go to you first. First and foremost. So think about that when you're thinking about the challenges that you have, or the discomfort that you're feeling, or the disruptions that you're going through. After that period of disruption ends and you're in the comfort zone, don't forget to take that time of rest and relaxation and processing. My mentor, Nadia Dzhokhmetova, Dr. Nadia Dzhokhmetova, the queen of reinvention, says often, we do not learn by doing. We learn by reflecting on what we've done. So that time in processing is incredibly important. What I'd like to leave you with, what I propose, is that we learn to embrace fear and see it as an opportunity to challenge situations in order to overcome any suffering we might have. Yes, we're constantly looking for stability, for predictability. But we can never know what's going to happen to us next. We may try to control the uncontrollable, but the truth is, we can never avoid uncertainty, especially in these times of turbulence. I point, turbulence is part of the adventure. Yes, we're afraid. But the question is, do I choose to continue to live in fear? Or do I grow up and face the world and the challenges that it brings? Remember that one of the essential components of making it through these times of turbulence is to practice loving kindness. Giving yourself loving kindness is the best thing you can do. not just for yourself, but for others as well. Because if you're not well, if you don't take care of yourself with compassion, with empathy, you cannot be of service to others. So love is absolutely essential if we are to overcome our fears. I recently started reading a book called Passion and Purpose. It's a compilation of personal stories from Harvard School MBA graduates about their experiences in taking on the mantle of leadership in ways that are like unlike any previous generations before them. And you know what? This gives me hope. Hope that the world is changing for the better and that there is a younger generation that not only understands what needs to change, but who are working with and within the turbulence and making a personal decision to take steps, however small, however big, to make a difference. To bravely reshape businesses that badly need reshaping. To transform themselves, to transform leadership, and possibly to transform the world. Whatever fears they have are being channeled for good. In the foreword to this book, Harvard professor of management practice, Bill George, quoted Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I'm going to share this quote with you. I think it's beautiful. "Few will have the greatness to bend history itself. But each of us can work to change a small portion of events. It is from numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. It's these small steps, a daily meditation, a journal entry, a reflection, an awareness of your fears, and small, tiny action to move beyond the fear, or a simple small act of loving kindness for others and for yourself that I call the courage to change." Finally, I don't think we can talk about the courage to change without talking about meaning. Because when we talk about reinventing ourselves or our career, remember, this is a show about career reinvention. We are essentially talking about what will bring meaning to our lives. I'm sure many of you have heard of Viktor Frankl, a Jewish psychologist who spent time in Auschwitz, the German concentration camp during the Second World War. Frankl's experience in Auschwitz reinforced one of the key ideas he had, and that was that life is not primarily a quest for power or pleasure, but it's a search for meaning. He saw that there could be meaning in work, in other words, doing something significant. There could be meaning in love, in caring for another person. And there could be meaning in courage during difficult times. Here's a quote from his famous book, Man's Search for Meaning, a must read, by the way. "When we can no longer change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. Everything can be taken from a human, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way." I'll leave you with that thought. If you cannot change a situation, think of changing yourself. Because ultimately, that is the one thing you can control. You've been listening to Danielle Silverman on Reinventing You, where we talk about reinventing your career and bringing more meaning into your work and into your life. Until next time. Bye for now. Thank you for listening to Reinventing You with me, your host, Danielle Silverman. Tune in on the second and fourth Monday each month at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join me and feel inspired and optimistic about your future. We only get one life, so embrace change and thrive with me. Find work that aligns best with your soul and what you enjoy. For more information, go to reinventingyou.com.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.